Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 617 Squadron, The Dam Busters at War, by Tom Bennett. Narrated by Dennis Kleinman. Introduction. And it came to pass. My introduction to 617 Squadron was somewhat involuntary and backdoor. I finished my first tour of operational duty in February 1943, having flown with No. 49 Squadron in No. 5 Group since August 1942. I was posted for duties in the operations room at 5 Group headquarters at St. Vincent's Grantham, where I stayed for 6 very informative months. At my own request, I was posted for instructional duties at No. 1654 Heavy Conversion Unit at RAF Wigsley and performed the duties of a radar navigation instructor. In April 1944, I was posted to RAF Wyton near Huntingdon for a second tour of operations with Pathfinder Force, PFF, No. 8 Group Bomber Command. I arrived at the officers' mess Wyton at about 16:30 hours on the Easter Monday, having been granted a 48-hour pass to spend the Easter holiday with my family in Ilford, Essex. Tea was being served in the anteroom, so I left all my luggage in the foyer and went in. I knew that many of my former aircrew friends were already serving at Wyton, and so I was not really surprised to hear a yell of welcome as I collected my tea. I turned to see Squadron Leader Tommy Blair bearing down on me, a broad smile across his round mustachioed face. Tommy had been the bombing leader during my tour with 49 Squadron, and, strangely enough, had been the very first officer to greet me when I entered the officers' mess at RAF Scampton for the first time as a newly commissioned pilot officer, after having served 5 months on the squadron as an NCO. "Bloody glad to see you, Ben," he boomed, putting my cup of tea in jeopardy as he pumped my hand. "It's about time 5 Group started to send us some real navigators." I settled down with him, avidly talking about the old days on 49 Squadron under Wing Commander Leonard Slee. Suddenly, our lively conversation was rudely interrupted by the mess tannoy. "Would Flying Officer Bennett please come to the phone?" I ignored the call, since I felt that doubtless there were other doubles about the place, and who would know that I'd reported in but a short time previously. However, when the message was repeated plaintively for a third time, and Tommy had moved off to speak to another officer, I went out to the telephone merely to reassure myself that it was someone else that was being paged. "Hello, Ben," came a voice that I recognized immediately as that of Jerry Falk, the pilot with whom I had been crewed up at No. 19 OTU RAF Kinloss in February 1942, and with whom I had shared my first tour. I listened uncomprehendingly as he continued. "I'm sending a gharry over to Wyton for you, Ben, to bring you across to Warboys with all your gear. It's on its way and has been told to pick you up from the officers' mess, so don't leave there. We're converting to Mossies at Warboys and then joining 617 Squadron for target marking duties. I'll give you all the griff when you arrive over here, mate." And with that, he rang off. Sure enough, a van turned up and collected me from the mess. In the interim, I'd been unable to find Tommy Blair to explain to him that I'd probably spent the shortest tour at Wyton of any aircrew, and if he reads these words today, it will solve a mystery that has been puzzling him for the last 40 years. Incidentally, I was to learn many years later that a very similar thing had happened to Dave Shannon. He had arrived as a volunteer for PFF duties at Wyton in late February 1943, only to receive a telephoned invitation from Wing Commander Gibson to return to 5 Group to join a new squadron that he was forming in the group. Dave returned to Lincolnshire with all haste. I guess it was incidents like this that caused Air Vice Marshal D.C.T. Bennett, the AOC No. 8 Group, to have rather a querulous attitude towards the upstart 617 Squadron in the later stages of the war. Jerry told me that he had heard of my PFF posting whilst he had been a staff instructor at the Lancaster Finishing School at RAF Syerston, Lincoln. At the same time, the Bush Telegraph had passed the message that Leonard Cheshire was seeking aircrew to man Mosquito aircraft for low-level target marking, and there weren't many takers. Jerry had leapt into a Lancaster and headed swiftly for RAF Woodhall Spa. He managed to get an interview with a 617 Squadron commander who was impressed by Jerry's record and accepted him for the role. Jerry blurted out the story of my posting to PFF and that he was certain that I would only be too pleased to join forces with him again. "I will get the necessary posting amendments put in hand immediately," said Chesh, "and Flying Officer Bennett can join you at War Boys for the conversion course and return to Woodhall with the other lads." Well, that's how it all came about. I knew very little about 617, save what was general knowledge around 5 Group and Bomber Command. The very real feeling of thankfulness that I had in knowing that I was going back to war in 5 Group and with Jerry Falk did much to dampen down any secret qualms I may have had about the posting, and anyway, I could always console myself with the thought that at least I'd maintained the old service tradition of not volunteering for anything. 617 Squadron was officially formed at RAF Scampton on 1 April 1943, April Fool's Day, and the 25th anniversary of the formation of the Royal Air Force. The Dan's Raid, which was carried out so magnificently on the night of 16 and 17 May 1943, remains the most outstanding individual bomber squadron feat of the whole war. Quite properly, it stands as a lasting memorial to the courage and devotion of all bomber aircrew throughout the conflict. Besides lifting the civilian morale, it boosted the spirits and efforts of the thousands of aircrew with other bomber command squadrons then engaged in the bitter bomber battles against the German enemy. It has rightly secured an imperishable niche in British history. Wing Commander Gibson relinquished command of the squadron after the Dam's Raid and was succeeded by Squadron Leader George Holden, DSO DFC, who had previously served in No. 4 Group in Yorkshire. On 6 July 1943, he led 6 aircraft against electric power installations at Aquata Scrivia near Genoa, whilst another 6 aircraft attacked the transformer station at San Polo de Enza. All 12 aircraft flew on to North Africa after the bombing and landed at RAF Blida without loss. They left Blida on 25 July and bombed the harbour and shipping at Leghorn en route for Scampton. On 29 July, the squadron carried out leaflet raids on the large towns of northern Italy. Again they landed at Blida and returned later to the United Kingdom, this time without attacking any enemy target on the way back. The squadron transferred en bloc from RAF Scampton to RAF Coningsby on 30 August 1943. For 2 successive nights, 14 and 15 and 15 and 16 September, the squadron's target at low level was the Dortmund-Ems Canal at Ladbergen in Germany. In that short period, 6 of the 9 crews detailed were lost without the canal being breached, the cause being the fog that enveloped the target area. Among the casualties was George Holden and, with him, practically the remainder of the crew that had flown with Guy Gibson on the Dam's Raid. Some 30 minutes after landing after the second of these attacks, Flight Lieutenant Mick Martin, DSO DFC, captain of one of the 3 surviving crews, was discussing the reasons for the outcome of the operation with Air Vice Marshal Sir Ralph Cochrane, AOC No. 5 Group, who had hastened to Coningsby and was obviously shocked by the losses sustained. Mick told of the poor visibility en route, the dense fog at the immediate target area, the presence of unexpected light flak defences, and the long search for the target. Suddenly Sir Ralph said, "You are a squadron leader as from now, and acting commander of 617. On the very next night, 16 and 17 September, the squadron was required to supply 6 aircraft for a raid on the Anthior Viaduct in southern France, near Nice. 3 of the dam's crews of Les Monroe, Joe McCarthy and Ken Brown were supplemented by Bunny Clayton, Ted Usman and Dave Wilson. No. 106 Squadron also contributed 6 aircraft to this operation with their squadron commander, Wing Commander Abercrombie, in overall command of the whole force. The raid was not a success, and the aircraft again flew on to Blida, returning to the United Kingdom some days later without operating against any enemy target. In the considered opinion of Leonard Cheshire many years later, Mick Martin was the greatest operational pilot that the Air Force produced. He had long been a devotee of the straight, hard, and low approach to bomber operations, and had so developed these tactics personally as to know instinctively how to combat and nullify enemy reaction. The fact that he survived the war unharmed, despite a very long operational career, is proof that he never made a mistake under pressure. Mick had assumed command of 617 Squadron, very much aware through his regular and thorough contacts with Barnes Wallace that Tallboy bombs were off the drawing board and in production, and that the larger Grand Slams were being planned. The scientist had used wind tunnel tests to evolve perfect aerodynamic contouring for the Tallboy. He had set the tail fins at an angle of 3 degrees to the longitudinal axis of the bomb. In flight, this caused the bomb to rotate around that axis at ever-increasing revolutions until the whole bomb became stabilized like a gyroscope. Barnes Wallace required a bombing accuracy of within 20 yards of the target and maintained that these two bombs would be the most perfect and accurate ever conceived. He told Mick, "If you can attain an accuracy of 20 yards, the explosive power of my beautiful bombs and their earthquake effect will do much to smash the Nazi war arsenal." Naturally, the key factor in achieving the accuracy worthy of the bomb designs was the facility to aim them precisely, and the solution to this lay with a stabilized automatic bombsight, SABS. The key mathematical data required to set up the SABS for such precise results were A. The aircraft's airspeed at the moment of bomb release, which conditioned the bomb's trajectory to the effect of wind speed and direction. B. The aircraft and bomb release speed over the ground. C. Exact release height above target. D. The immediate outside air temperature. This indirectly indicated air density, which, in turn, governed the falling velocity and forward pitch of the bomb. A 1 degree centigrade error in the outside temperature automatically fed into the system a bombing error of 21 feet. Thus, a 3 degree centigrade error meant an error of 21 yards, which was not acceptable. The reading on the thermometer normally fitted to the Lancaster was found to be unreliable. The indicated reading was raised by the cabin temperature inside the aircraft. Also, despite the use of a deflector, the friction heat generated by the airflow compressing on that part of the thermometer which protruded through the aircraft's skin to measure the temperature of the outside air also raised the reading. The greater the airspeed, the more friction heat was generated and the larger the induced error from this source. Mick was in constant touch with Arnold Hall, later knighted, and his staff at Farnborough. A thermometer was devised and produced which was calibrated by airspeed, because airspeed meant frictional pressure on the bulb, which in turn registered a false ambient heat. The squadron navigators were furnished with a formula with which they balanced two thermometer readings to arrive at the precise outside air temperature for use in compiling the vital SABS settings. Thus, the squadron aircraft needed to arrive at their bombing height as early as possible, bearing in mind the strategic and tactical requirements of a particular operation. Consequently, Mick Martin laid great emphasis on SABS training whilst in temporary command of 617 Squadron. He interviewed volunteer crews and accepted only those he instinctively knew had the right attitude for 617's future needs. Soon the whole squadron was totally absorbed in mastering the intricacies and demands of the SABS. The bombsight demanded a long run-up to the target, with airspeed and height rigorously and unflinchingly maintained. At the same time, Mick saw to it that the dam-busting techniques were practiced and kept up to date. The survivors of the dam's raid had raised the subject of the feasibility of the low-level and accurate marking of targets visually as a result of their experiences. Mick Martin had the correct previous operational experience and background in low-level flying to lead and foster these discussions until they crystallized into convictions. The 617 aircrews were convinced that this type of accurate marking was a prime necessity if the SABS was to be used to its very best advantage in delivering bomb loads to targets. Wing Commander Leonard Cheshire, DSO-DFC, was appointed to command 617 Squadron on 10 November 1943. On 11 November, 10 aircraft under the command of Squadron Leader Mick Martin made another attack on the Antheor Viaduct. 4 aircraft attacked the viaduct, while 6 attacked a bridge and embankment near Nice. The force again flew on to Blida, returning on 18 November. Ted Usman and crew disappeared on this transit flight, which was routed via Gibraltar and the Bay of Biscay. The absence of a large number of the aircrew personnel of the squadron in North Africa had afforded Leonard Cheshire the opportunity of getting to know the layout and setup at Coningsby, and, more importantly, of introducing himself to the remainder of the aircrew and the very competent NCOs and staff of the squadron's ground crew. He appreciated that he had a tremendously experienced and devoted aircrew contingent, and soon impressed his own very individual personality upon every member of the squadron. Leonard Cheshire had been the commanding officer of RAF Marston Moor in Yorkshire when the news of the dam's raid broke. The operation was a great boost to Bomber Command morale, and Group Captain Cheshire was very impressed and very anxious to know more of how it was achieved, but it never occurred to him for a moment that it was a squadron with which he would become involved. A special dispensation had been necessary from Air Ministry for him to assume his Marston Moor command, but he hated the job. His honesty told him that he did not fit into it, since he just did not know the ground rules, and he was desperate to get out of what was becoming an intolerable position and back to flying again. He realized, however, that there would have to be some special and powerful pleading to get his AOC, Air Vice Marshal Carr, to demote him to Wing Commander rank. Air Vice Marshal Donald Bennett, the AOC Pathfinder Group, visited Marston Moor, and Leonard approached him for a posting into Pathfinder Force. He was taken aback when the AVM said he did not really know, and that in any case it would be necessary for Leonard to go through a trial period to see if he measured up to requirements. Leonard replied as politely as he could what the AVM could do with that offer, as he, Cheshire, had already completed 3 operational tours with Bomber Command. His next step, in desperation, was to go to a psychiatrist and plead that he was heading for a nervous breakdown unless he could be returned to flying duties, but he did not hold out much hope that anything would come of that ploy. He kept trying every possible avenue and generally, he now feels, made a nuisance of himself. 617 Squadron had never occurred to him as a possibility, and he's not sure if he was even aware that George Holden, another number 4 group officer, had taken over command from Guy Gibson. Quite how it came about he does not recall, but he found himself being driven down to number 5 group headquarters at St. Vincent's Grantham, Lincolnshire, to see Air Vice Marshal Sir Ralph Cochrane, the AOC. The appointment to the command of 617 Squadron out of the blue was an almost unbelievable gift from heaven. Prior to his departure for the interview, Leonard had been warned that Cochrane was a very tough man, with no sense of humour, and someone Leonard would not find easy to accept. His own impression was completely different. He felt immediately at home with the AVM and was delighted to be offered the command at the end of a thorough and searching interview. Sir Ralph told Cheshire that Leonard would have to do a 2-week course for Lancaster conversion. Somewhat arrogantly, Leonard assured the AVM that this was not necessary, but Sir Ralph just smiled and waved him out of the office. The AVM's judgment proved completely right. The conversion course, with Squadron Leader Gunter as his instructor and mentor, taught Leonard the Lancaster inside out, and also retaught him 1 or 2 fundamentals that he had forgotten. The squadron buckled down to the intensive training schedule introduced by Mick Martin. Wing Commander Cheshire avidly absorbed all the knowledge he could from Mick's operational experience of low flying, and acknowledges that all he ever knew and learned about the low flying game came from Mick Martin, albeit he never really reached McMartin's ability and stature in this sphere. Cheshire had long advocated that bombing accuracy should be improved if the full fruits of the bomber offensive were to be gathered. He was tremendously impressed with the commitment to this ideal that permeated 617's squadron and realized that a weapon was being forged that could revolutionize bomber tactics, given the right tools and encouragement. On 9 December 1943, four crews were detached to RAF Tempsford to assist in the supply-dropping operations to French resistance groups. Two of these crews were lost on 11 December. Several times the squadron was briefed for operations against flying bomb sites, but the weather interfered and the operations were cancelled. It was to be 16 December before Cheshire was able to lead his squadron against these sites. On 9 January 1944, 617 Squadron moved up the road from Coningsby to RAF Woodhall Spa. The early operations in the following period were allied to PFF marking, which proved totally inadequate for the bombing purposes of 617. At a meeting in Bomber Command headquarters, Cheshire stated that the squadron's requirement was for a maximum 20 yards marking error. Air Vice Marshal Donald Bennett stated that this was totally beyond achievement, to which Cheshire replied, "Not if the marking is done at low level." The AVM dismissed this as impossible because of the danger to the pilot, who would inevitably fly into the ground if he attempted a complicated marking operation at 200 feet at night. Eventually, the matter was thrown back to 617's own resources with a strict proviso that it was not to be carried out below 2,500 feet and that a high-level bomb site was to be used. Cheshire argued that the bomb site would not work effectively at this height and that they would get the worst possible conditions for both light and heavy ACAC fire. In effect, he was told to lump it and return to the squadron somewhat disheartened, but his spirits were soon raised by the enthusiasm and bonhomie of his aircrew. The flying bomb targets were to be discontinued by Bomber Command, but Sir Ralph managed to get some sites set aside for 617 to pursue its objectives, initially against lightly defended targets. On 24 January 1944, the squadron carried out its first independent operation with Cheshire and Mick as the marker crews. They made it a point of honour to endeavour to mark the target from height, but this proved a total failure, so they resorted to a low-level run, with Mick going in first to show how it could be done. The target was then accurately marked and bombed. A similar sequence on 25 January brought a similar result, and Cheshire made Sir Ralph privy to the procedure. Sir Ralph was then convinced that the low-level method was feasible, whereas the medium-level failed. He gave very strong support to further operations with this low-level marking as the featured method of target marking, and on 8 February 1944, the crucial Limoges raid was carried out. The results were almost unbelievable. Specific workshops and buildings in the industrial complex were completely destroyed with no casualties to the French population. The squadron was on its way. On 12 February 1944, 10 aircraft positioned at RAF Ford advanced base for a third attack on the Anthior Viaduct. The raid was not a success for various reasons and factors, but is remembered for McMartin's epic flight to Sardinia after being very badly damaged by the defences around the viaduct area. His bomb aimer, Bob Hay, was buried at Cagliari in Sardinia. Bob had been the five-group bombing leader before joining 617 Squadron. An Australian, he was universally popular throughout the group for his bombing knowledge and capability, and also for his marvellous personality and general love of life. The news of his death in action was a cause of great sadness to the whole of Five Group, where every squadron mourned his passing. This proved to be McMartin's last operation with the squadron. He was awarded a bar to the DSO, and on 21 March was posted to Headquarters No. 100 Group to commence a career that was to lead him through a succession of well-merited promotions and commands to appointment on the Air Staff as Air Member for Personnel and eventual retirement with the rank of Air Marshal as Sir Harold Martin, KCB, DSO and Bar, DFC and Two Bars, AFC. His influence on the development of the 617 technique of target marking remained paramount for the rest of the war. The squadron continued its successful way, still using Lancasters in the low-level marking role against specific French and Belgian targets, but Leonard Cheshire was agitating for a smaller and faster aircraft if the system was to be employed against tougher targets. On 27 March, he commenced a short detachment to RAF Colby Grange in Lincolnshire to convert to mosquito flying. On 5 April, he used a Mossy for the marking role against an aircraft repair depot at Toulouse. The results confirmed the aircraft's outstanding suitability for the role. Sir Arthur Harris authorized a further 3 Mosquitoes for the 617 marker force on the express understanding that 617 would retain the Mossies only if Munich was severely mauled as a result of their use in a marking role. Operational success continued to come 617's way, and Munich was duly severely damaged on the night of 24 and 25 April 1944 when 5 group squadrons were led in by the markers of 617. They followed a 5-week layoff from operations to solve and develop the technique for Operation Taxable. 617's feat of imposing a huge invasion convoy on the enemy radar screens in the Pas-de-Calais area, using the silver foil strips, window and the G navigation grid. On 8 and 9 June, the 12,000-pound Tallboy bomb made its operational debut against the Saumur Tunnel, effectively sealing the German reinforcements from southern France in transit to the Normandy battlefields. With this operation began another peak in the squadron's history. Leonard Cheshire had fashioned a highly motivated and dedicated squadron from the very experienced aircrew who had come from all over Bomber Command to join 617. The tremendous regard in which he was held by all ranks, added to the superb leadership he continuously demonstrated, made them feel they could achieve the impossible, and the Saumur Tunnel raid heralded a run of success that was to last into July. Their technique made for the destruction of a large number of German E-boats in Le Havre on 14 June, with quite severe damage being inflicted on the submarine pens in the inner harbour by Tallboys. The squadron was given the task of destroying the huge concrete structures that the Germans were building in the Pas-de-Calais. 617 was the only squadron in Bomber Command that had the capacity to deliver Tallboys accurately against these targets. The crews were kept on continual standby, waiting for the cloud to clear from the target area, and it was not until 24 June that they were able to open their offensive. With the exception of a very successful operation on the night of 3 and 4 June against the underground flying bomb rocket stores at Saint-Loup-de-Sarat, all 617's operations were concentrated specifically against these sites until 28 July, when the Allied armies overran the area and captured the sites. Wing Commander J.B. Tate, DSO DFC, assumed command on 12 July 1944. A very different type of personality, but a very effective leader by example, Willie Tate led 617 to more glory. The submarine pens in ports in France and Holland felt the hammer blows of 617 until the end of August, when training was undertaken for a new target. With the Allied advance on the continent, 617 had no further need for their Mosquito aircraft, which were withdrawn, and the squadron reverted to being an all-Lancaster outfit. Willie led them on all 3 raids to finally sink the German battleship Tirpitz at her anchorage in Tromsø, interspersed with the breaching of the Kems barrage across the Rhine near Basel. With a British love of alliteration, he became known as Tirpitz Tate. Willie handed over command to the Canadian group captain Johnny Fauquier on 28 December 1944. 617 Squadron continued their special duties role and were especially active in the campaign to isolate the Ruhr Valley area in front of the advancing Allied armies by destroying railway and road bridges. The fearsome Grand Slam, a much larger version of the Tallboy, was added to their armory, and the Bielefeld Viaduct capitulated to its awesome power. The German pocket battleship Lützow was another naval scalp for the squadron, and the submarine pens at Farge in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?